Imagine a world with no leaders, no presidents, no generals, no bosses, no central control.
Ants have successfully occupied every continent on Earth. They use a system with no central control, which we term collective behavior.
But what is collective behavior? How do we begin to understand behaviors that emerge in a spontaneous way?
Dr. Deborah Gordon, professor of biology at Stanford University, joined us to talk all about collective behavior in ants.
I'm Kinsey.
I'm Jeff.
This is Radio Bio.
Don't know much biology.
Hello and welcome to Radio Bio. Today we're talking with Dr. Deborah Gordon, a professor of biology at Stanford University. Welcome, Dr. Gordon.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about what you study?
I study collective behavior in ants because I'm interested in systems that operate without central control. And ants are a great example of that. Ants always live in colonies consisting of one or more reproductive females, and we call them queens, but they don't really have any power or authority. They're not in charge. They don't tell anybody what to do. And all the ants that you see walking around are sterile female workers.
All of them?
Yes.
Where are the males?
In most ant species, the males are only alive for a few weeks to mate, and then they die.
Already mind blown. I did not know that. Okay, so you mentioned collective behavior, and you mentioned no central, like...
Control.
But what is collective behavior generally?
There are many systems in nature that work without central control,
mm-hmm.
and they all work using local interactions. So a brain is a great example. There's no neuron in your brain that tells the other neurons to think about ants. Somehow, through the interaction of neurons that connect and stimulate each other to fire, you can think about ants. And an ant colony is another system like that, where the ants, using very local interactions, in the aggregate, colonies can do interesting things, but no ant understands what needs to be done or makes an assessment about what happens next.
Dr. Gordon mentioned that collective behavior is ubiquitous in nature. Collective behaviors are central to the survival of many species. You've probably seen nature documentaries with large schools of fish moving together to distract or avoid being eaten by a predator. This rapid change in direction of the fish result from propagation of local interactions.
Our own brains are another example. A brain has lots of neurons, each of which can only do something very simple, but together the whole brain can think.
So why do you study collective behavior?
I study collective behavior because I'm interested in how a system can work and grow and reproduce without anybody in charge.
And so there's no central control, there's no one in charge of, in this case, an ant colony or a brain. What's the process then by which those roles kind of naturally get propagated?
In many biological systems, like an ant colony or different cells inside a body, the individual cells or the individual ants are doing certain tasks at certain times.
Yeah.
And in some systems, it's more irreversible than others. But just as a stem cell can become many different kinds of cells, so an ant can do many different kinds of tasks. And that is determined, like everything else in an ant colony, by very simple patterns of interactions among ants. Just as in a developing embryo, what kind of cell a certain cell becomes is determined by interactions among cells.
Okay, so back with the ants, what kinds of interactions are these ants having to determine their individual behaviors?
Most of the interactions that regulate the behavior of a colony in ants are olfactory. They're based on smell. So most species of ants can't see very well. There are some exceptions, but all of them can smell really well. And they smell with their antennae. So when one ant touches another with its antennae, it's smelling the other ant. And one of the basic kinds of interactions that we see all the time in many different species of ants is an antennal contact. So if you watch ants, you see one ant touch another with its antennae, it's smelling the other ant. And what it's smelling is a layer basically of grease on the surface of the ant's body that carries an odor. And that's, for example, how an ant knows when it smells another ant if that other ant is a nestmate or not. So they're using just this, so ants are using the rate at which they contact and smell each other to decide what to do.
So it's what they're smelling and the rate at which they're making this smelling contact?
Yes, the rate at which they meet other ants.
Okay.
So we do experiments where we take little glass beads and we cover them with this extract, the smell that's on an ant's body, and we can introduce those beads at a certain rate, and the ants will respond as if they met other ants. And that's how we know that all that it takes is the simple contact, because the glass bead isn't doing anything. It's not saying anything else.
Yeah.
It's just sitting there smelling like an ant.
It's not even an ant.
It's not an ant. It smells like an ant.
It smells like one. Okay. Yeah.
And so how then does this interaction, this olfactory interaction, then lead to the changing of a role? Let's say like a queen dies, how does that role then get filled? Is it a certain number of interactions or type of interactions that a specific ant is undergoing where it then becomes the queen? Or how does that process take place?
Being a queen or not being a queen in ants is rarely determined by interactions.
Okay.
So in most ant species, whether an ant is a queen is determined before it even comes out of the pupa as an adult, but sometime when it's a larva, or maybe even before.
So I learned something here. The queen is not a role to be filled by interactions. Queens are queens, and it's usually determined before they transition into an adult. But the tasks that ants do, like foraging, can change based on the frequency of interactions that an ant experiences.
The kinds of tasks that ants can change and that could be regulated by interactions are more like what the ant is doing, whether it's a forager, whether it's cleaning out the nest, whether it's taking care of the brood. And those are the interactions that are regulated through the transitions between tasks like foraging or nest maintenance are the kinds of transitions that can be regulated by simple interactions.
So you mentioned earlier that the ants that, in general, that we see out walking around are all female. And you mentioned these different kinds of tasks that they're doing. So how does this group, have you studied like how groups of ants decide to switch from, say, foraging to nest building?
Yes, I've studied.
What does that look like?
So the process that shifts the effort allocated to different tasks, I call it task allocation.
Okay.
And I've studied that in harvester ants. There's really two parts to it. One is whether an ant is a forager or a nest maintenance worker.
Oh.
But the other is whether an ant who's a forager will go out right now. So there's really two steps to the decision. One is, what would I do if I were doing something? And then what gets me to do it?
Yeah.
And both of those can be mediated by interactions. The kinds of interactions that ants use always depend on smell, and there are really two kinds that are most common. One is when ants smell each other by touching antennae, but the other is when ants smell a chemical that's been put out by the other. So that's another kind of interaction based on smell. And that's the one that's probably most familiar to people because you see trails of ants on your kitchen counter, especially if you live in Northern California or anywhere actually on the California coastline. The Argentine ants are one of the species of ants that make trails. So the way that that works is that an ant puts down a chemical on the surface where it's walking, and another ant comes along and smells it. So it's also an interaction involving smell, but there's a little bit of a lag because one ant put down the smell and then the other one comes along and finds it. So both of those kinds of interactions can affect what an ant is doing and whether it does it right now.
So we're talking about smells and pheromones. We can't smell what the ants are smelling. So how does one study these chemicals?
We really don't have very good ways of studying the chemicals.
Yeah.
The chemicals on the surface of the ant are not pheromones. It's a kind of greasy substance, think Vaseline, that keeps the ant from drying out. And many species of insects have that. And that we can extract off the ant by doing something really bad to the ant, drop the ant in a solvent, and the the substance that they're called cuticular hydrocarbons. They're long-chain fatty acids, and it dissolves off the ant. And then we have some in the test tube, and then we can put that on something else. So the pheromones that ants produce are produced in really tiny quantities, and we can't measure it as they do it. And so we have to do something really crude, which is to dissect an ant and get the whole gland that produces that pheromone, maybe a lot of them, put it on a piece of paper or something and put it out there and see what the ants do. And I always think of that experiment as if, you know, I think of that experiment as if the Martians were trying to understand how we communicate.
I love it. I think about that all the time when I capture lizards. Like, I'm a big Martian and I capture them.
And they drop a giant sign that says blue, crashes through the ceiling, and there it is in the middle of the room, and the people start running around, and the Martians think, oh, blue means run around. But of course, this sign came at a strange time in a strange way, in a completely different way from the way that we would use the word blue. And so our reaction doesn't really tell us what blue means, doesn't really tell the Martians what blue means.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing that when we take a huge amount of some substance and we present it to ants and we see a certain reaction, we don't really know how that corresponds to the way that the ants would respond to it at the time that they would be using it and in the tiny quantities that they would be using it. So we really don't have a very good way of investigating ant pheromones. But we can see that they're putting them out. We can extract them. So we know that they are using them. So we can learn a lot by seeing what the ants do, how they put down the pheromone, and how the other ants react. But we can't really talk to them with pheromone in the way that they are using it, because we can't measure it.
Wow. That's such a good explanation, the dropping the big blue down.
No, it's kind of like that classic, almost physics-based, like, treatment effect. It's, are they responding to the actual signal or responding to you giving the signal?
I think that's a standard problem in doing experiments where you intervene, that you don't know how the magnitude of your intervention corresponds with the range that the organism usually responds to. And I think that's the most interesting part of being a field biologist. That's really why I like to work in the field, because I like to try to design disturbances, design experiments that are large enough to make a difference so I can see the effect, but not so large that I'm seeing the response to something that would never ordinarily happen.
Yeah.
And it's very tricky to find that range.
Yeah.
So we've discussed what collective behavior means and how it occurs in ants, but how do scientists study this in natural systems?
We asked Dr. Gordon what kinds of experiments she uses to assess what controls collective behavior.
So the experiments that we do are mostly trying to understand how they use interactions to regulate their foraging activity. So an ant inside the nest, a forager, goes out when it meets enough returning foragers with food. So it doesn't go out until enough ants have come in with food to stimulate it to leave the nest. So we do experiments where we change that, like we catch the ants coming in, and that reduces the rate at which they meet ants coming in with food. We take those ants and put them in a little box. We always let them go afterwards. And then we can see how changing the rate at which ants come in changes the rate at which they go out. So we're trying to understand exactly how interactions regulate the rate at which they decide to forage.
Wow. How do you keep all the ants in the box?
Well, a very important tool of ant researchers is some stuff called fluon, which is liquid Teflon. And some ants can't climb over that. It's too slippery.
At a species level or even a colony to colony level, how much does that, for example, number of interactions that controls before a forager goes out, how much does that change? Is there almost like a specific number that they have to undergo every single ant in that colony before they can go out? And does that change by ant within the colony and between colonies?
Colonies differ in how they use interactions to regulate foraging. And we've actually found that natural selection is acting on those differences. So colonies that regulate foraging so as to conserve water seem to be doing better, at least they have been during the drought. Mm-hmm. So there are differences among colonies. Different species use interactions in really different ways, and I think that's the most interesting question about ants. They give us such an opportunity to see how the collective behavior in different environments has evolved to be different. So for harvester ants in the desert, it's really important to save water. And so they have evolved this system that keeps an ant from going out unless things are good enough to make it worth it. Mm-hmm. So the ant is waiting to get enough interactions from ants coming in with food that is correlated with there being enough food out there that it's worth it to go out and be worth losing water walking around in the hot sun. So of course the ant doesn't know that it's making this calculation, but the colony is making that calculation mm-hmm. by having this rule. Colonies differ though in how willing they are to go out for food when it's hot. And so the colonies that are less willing to go out when it's really hot and dry are saving water. They're sacrificing food, but they're saving water. And at least during the time of the drought, those are the ones that are having more offspring colonies.
Wow. That's a really elegant example of natural selection on this
collective behavior. Yes.
Yeah. So has anybody ever looked at or tried to test if these collective behaviors are learned or inherited?
Nobody has ever been able to get an ant to learn anything.
Yeah.
So it's pretty clear that the ants are not learning them. It doesn't really answer the question of how the ant knows what to do.
Right.
But we don't really know that about any animal.
Right. Is the word instinct, or what is it? Like, that they know what to do.
For me, the word instinct is just a name for what we don't know. So yeah. We call it instinct because we don't really know what's going on.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm just going down probably questions. Kind of this weird philosophical rabbit hole a little bit, but I mean, the way you're describing it, it really is like these neurons firing. And so at what point do you almost separate out a colony and an individual? Is each individual its behavior only a function of the colony's behavior, or is there sometimes like rogue ants and like individual behaviors that occur independent of the colony?
I think that is a philosophical rabbit hole, and I think that we are used to thinking of ourselves as independent individuals that operate autonomously, and so we have these questions about ourselves. Am I doing what I'm doing because it comes from me, or does it come from someone else? The ants don't worry about that, and the neurons definitely don't worry mm-hmm. about that. So I don't think you can really separate out what the ant is doing. Everything an ant does is in the context of the colony, but the colony is only a bunch of ants. Mm-hmm. As to rogue ants, there are ants who don't go the same direction as the others. I mean, if you watch ants at all, you can see it's very messy. They yeah. never really look like every ant knows exactly what to do and mm-hmm. is marching off to do its job. So that's probably how cells behave also. If we could watch them that carefully, we would probably see the same thing. But what you don't see is an ant trying to act on its own behalf at the expense of everybody else because it has some sense that it wants to get more for itself and keep it from the others and so on. Mm-hmm. You don't see that. You know, people talk about cancer as a rogue cell, like the cancer is trying to make more cells that are cancerous, that are going to defeat the healthy body and so on. But all cells are trying to reproduce and do what they do in the context of other cells, and cancer cells are no different. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, the notion of the rogue individual, the rogue cell, the rogue ant comes from ideas about human society and the conflict between what an individual wants and what's good for the society.
Exactly.
But we don't really see that conflict in nature. Mm-hmm. So when we think about symbiosis or mutualism, we can think about the different players acting in a way that benefits their kind and draws on the work or the functioning of the other kind. But it's not really the case that one is sort of trying to pull more stuff for the other for itself and at the expense of the other. So we really have a lot of examples in nature of independent entities that work together without a lot of conflict over who gets the most of something. So although we use that economic model to think about nature, we don't really see nature working that way.
So every time you see the ants go marching in, remember all of the interactions that led to each of those ants walking across your table.
This episode of Radio Bio was produced by Yamari Vasquez and edited by Jeff Lauder. Interviewers were Kinsey Brock and Jeff Lauder. Episode artwork by Kinsey Brock.
Radio Bio is produced by graduate students at the University of California, Merced. Support for Radio Bio comes from the Quantitative and Systems Biology Graduate Group, the School of Natural Sciences, and the Graduate Division at UC Merced. You can help support Radio Bio's mission of increasing scientific literacy in California's Central Valley and beyond by donating at giving.ucmerced.edu/radiobio. Find out more about our mission, events, and podcasts at www.radiobio.net.